Welcome to Bowden Education Podcast. In this podcast, we're speaking to Dr. Jonathan Barnes about refugee education. Jonathan, firstly, when we're talking about refugees and education, who actually are we talking about?
Well, we could be talking about a lot of different things because everybody is being educated all the time, of course. But specifically, I'm talking about those under 18 who have come to this country seeking asylum, seeking safety in this country. And there are very, very many of them coming on a virtually daily basis. And many of them are unaccompanied. They have no parents with them, no other relatives with them. They're on their own. They've been paid for. They've often been trafficked across vast stretches of land and country. And they've come here in incredibly dangerous situations. One of the kids I was talking to recently had seen several people drown on his journey across the Mediterranean, for example, just this week.
And in fact, I read that the Refugee Council have claimed that about 50% of all refugees across the world are in fact children. So we're talking about quite significant numbers.
Yep, I think it's 54% the UN are saying are under 18. Yeah, it's a big thing, and the vast majority of these are, of course, not in Europe. They're not on the way to Europe. 80 or 90% of them are in their own country, but in a different place in their own country, mm-hmm. seeking safety and shelter. And a huge number of those, if they're not in their own country, in the country next door. So, for example, huge refugee problem in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The vast majority, something like 300,000 a year, I think it is, are going to Uganda for support. And Uganda is giving them land and putting them up in refugee camps and so on. So we're not talking about many people to get as far as Europe.
Yeah, and I read as well, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that actually a large percentage of refugees are actually remaining in developing countries rather than perhaps the media impression that they're all trying to escape to developed, prosperous countries.
Absolutely. We're talking about 80 or 90% are within their own country or the next door country. Only a very well under 1% get as far as Europe. Well under 1%, sort of something like 0.2% of all people seeking refuge. And don't forget, there are a lot of other ways. It's not just war causing people to run away from their homes. Climate change has a major impact. I've just come back from Ethiopia, and people were telling me there we're on the front line of climate change. We can't sustain life where we are. We've got to move to a safer place. And again, it's within their own country.
Yeah. So bringing this back to the asylum seekers we find ourselves working with in the UK, why is refugee education so important?
There is an atmosphere that still is quite dominant in the press and in some communities of a hostile environment, and a feeling amongst a lot of people that refugees have come to this country to take jobs, to take advantage of our social services and our benefits and so on. And part of it, at least, is to correct that. Number one, what we've just been talking about, the whole business of there being very, very few. But number two, the huge majority of refugees are actually contributing more to this country in terms of taxes and services, because they're young, because they want to work, because they want to be part of a community. There are huge benefits, and the government papers and government information itself shows that refugees contribute about twice as much as they take from the system. But in terms of education, I work for a group called Education for Diversity, which helps schools integrate refugee young people, people under 18, help them integrate, first of all, socially, because actually taking refugees out of their sense of isolation, just like any other people, for example, if I'm an Afghan refugee or a refugee from Iraq, I want to stay with people who speak my language. I want to stay with people I'm familiar with. But of course, that's not healthy in a new country. It's much better if there's a sense of welcome and friendship and integration. And that's mainly what I'm working on, the education of refugees alongside people who are born in this country, people who are used to this country and have lives in this country already.
And so from your experience and perspective, and I'm going to move on to ask you about how your interest in refugee education came about, but what are the biggest challenges for refugee children when they arrive in our country and they're placed in homes, but then, of course, therefore schools? What do you consider are the significant barriers that they face?
The biggest barriers are ones of, am I going to be allowed to stay here? Am I going to be allowed to have status as a refugee? Because at first, these people who've come in boats and lorries and aeroplanes and various ways into the country, their first question is, am I going to be allowed to stay? Am I going to be allowed to stay in this country and get status as a refugee rather than someone seeking asylum?
And when they arrive in their schools, is there anything schools, teachers, head teachers can do to really make the transition for this group as easy as possible?
Well, I mean, even before they get to schools, there are problems. A lot of schools can't or won't, or it's the wrong time of year to take them at all. So many, I've just come from a meeting myself this morning where I heard that there are 40 unaccompanied minors here in Canterbury who haven't got a placement in school. They have just 2 hours a week of English teaching at a voluntary place called the Kent Refugee Action Network, and that's all the education they get. The rest of the time, they've got nothing to do. They're put up, they've got a flat or a room somewhere, or they're in a foster family, and they're not in school. So that's the first thing. The first barrier is, can I get to school? So the next barrier is, I don't know any English. I need to learn English. I've been in a school in Iraq or Iran or in Afghanistan or Syria. The school had computers, the school had gyms, the school had all the kinds of things that we might expect in a school. And yet, you know, I haven't got those things. I haven't even got English. So I need to learn English. But I also need to feel secure and at home in this country. So, you know, a lot of barriers, but also the kind of mental barrier of having dealt with the traumas of the journey. Many of them have had the traumas of either seeing a parent killed or seeing lots of dead bodies and lots of people they know disappeared and so on, depending on the country, but depending on the situation. Many of them have had traumatic experiences in their own house, in their own community, and then had major traumas on the journey itself.
So there's a whole range of areas of their life that really need support and joined up thinking, really, if you like, between home and housing. It's not just get them housed, it's about the education, and getting them into education as soon as possible, I would imagine, is beneficial.
Certainly so. Beneficial, you know, obviously on the learning side, and many of them are tremendously ambitious. They want jobs, and they often come from families where the kinds of jobs that they'd be wanting are in medicine, in pharmacology, in education. You know, they're often children of fairly well-off families in whatever communities they are, who can afford to pay the traffickers to to find them a place somewhere in Europe. So it's not, you know, these are not usually representatives of the poorest in the countries where they're escaping from. They're often children, young people who want education and want to go to university and so on.
And moving on from that, so again, it's the Refugee Council make a point that children in the UK asylum system actually contribute very positively to schools up and down the country. Can you explain in ways that you feel that such children do positively contribute?
I'm working at the moment with a school in Gravesend, which is a very diverse area. And every week, every Wednesday, a group of 10 young unaccompanied minors, some of them have status as refugees, some of them are applying for status as refugees, so they're still within the system, still hoping that they have permission to stay. They come every week and they just play table tennis or badminton or football or frisbee for an hour with the kids in the school, and then they have what's called a friendship club afterwards where they have cake and tea and just chat. What the sixth formers of that school are telling me is that this makes us feel we're doing something to build a better society, to build a better community where we are, to understand some of these big and controversial issues that the world is facing. 75 million people at the moment are displaced from their home in the world. Huge, huge numbers. And it gave the sixth form a sense that they were doing something to help address that issue by just offering friendship and downtime for these youngsters. So that was one thing. The other thing is the teachers in the schools I'm working with say that, you know, having contact with refugees makes them look at their own subject in a different way. They now are using illustrations from all over the world in their maths teaching, illustrations from all over the world in terms of talking about scientists or the impact of science on the environment and on our daily lives. Teachers are telling me that having contact with refugees actually changes the way they teach, changes the illustrations they use, changes the case studies and the exercises that they give to young people, and broadens it out and makes it more diverse, less Anglocentric, if you like.
So you've got it's sort of beneficial really all the way through, and that's something we do need to do across education, I think, is a real look at decolonization of our curriculum. What are we teaching children? What perspective, what books are we introducing children to? But also with regards to the students or the children themselves, it's about broadening their knowledge rather than perception that they may understand about asylum seeker children.
Absolutely right. I mean, all you have to do, in a sense, is have 2 or 3 weeks worth of contact with people from another culture, from another another lifestyle, and have the stories that they have, and you begin to change the way you think. Number one, you realize that they're humans and have the same human feelings, emotions, and needs as yourself. But number two, you begin to look at the world just slightly through their eyes, just slightly through their culture. And that contact, I think, is irreplaceable. I don't think there's anything that in any way comes close to helping us broaden our thinking, broaden our mindset about the diversity, especially in this country, one of the most diverse countries in the world.
And I think, therefore, the children that are interacting with your refugees in your context, the case study that you mentioned, perhaps going home and perhaps even correcting their parent views on what really refugees are, who they are, and what they bring, and what they
I think that is bound to happen, just as it's happening right now with discussions around the dinner table on climate change and Greta Thunberg's influence on our thinking on that. You know, that young people, I'm finding, certainly in the schools I'm working with in both London and Kent, that kids are talking about these big and controversial issues and taking it home, and those conversations are happening with many of the families too.
So I think it's quite obvious in a way what has generated your interest, but if you could talk to us about how did you get involved, what initially moved you to have such an interest in spending so much of your time working with this group of children?
I asked myself that question. Partly is because Cherry and I, you know, started our teaching life in Africa as migrants. We were migrants in Kenya for the first 3 years of our teaching life. And we were welcomed, we were made part of the community, we were not just accepted, but made really warmly welcome in the homes and the families of the kids we taught. I had classes of 70 kids who all wanted to learn, I used to have to stop them doing homework at 2 o'clock in the morning because they worked too hard. And things like that. And so I had this, you know, at the beginning of my career, incredibly positive influence from another culture, another country, another set of people. And through my life as a teacher, I've repeated that. I've taught in Malaysia as a migrant myself, living in another culture, being accepted warmly in a very strongly Muslim culture with no difficulty at all in both being accepted and welcomed, but also feeling part of that community. And in my life since I left Christchurch full-time, visiting Ethiopia, visiting India many times, the same feeling. So number one is that I know from personal experience, both as a teacher and a visitor, that other countries do welcome and a sense of integration very, very well with people like me. And I'd like to see my own country do that for other people. So that's one thing. There's a political driver. I feel that the world's a very unequal place, and that it's about time that we as a successful economy shared our good fortune with others who are less fortunate, have less resources, and more troubles in their both in their political and their geographical life. I mean, it's no coincidence that I think that most of the war-torn countries of the world also suffer from major natural disasters, again climate change, but also floods and droughts and so on, which have happened throughout their history. So there's that political driver, but also a very personal experience driver. And you know, when you're retired, I suppose you want to do something that makes sense of your own life. And so I'm devoting a lot of my time to that kind of thing.
And this is a whole nother discussion. I won't get you to comment on it, but I think our use of language is important as well. You talked of yourself there as a migrant, but so many people would actually refer to you as an expat during your time.
Well, and then others call you
as migrants. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, I certainly heard that language a lot when I lived in Kenya, but I saw myself as, you know, someone who was living in someone else's country, not a expat. It always just sounded so superior.
So, what do you think we can do better within our education system to accommodate our refugee community?
That's a really important question. I was working in a school in Hastings last year, and I was talking about the journey from Syria to England and which countries some of the refugee children went to. It was a primary school, and we were we were talking about refugees that had just recently arrived in Hastings. So it was kind of very current. And in that discussion, when I was talking about the journey, one little boy in the school said, "That's not the way I came." And it was the first time that child, who'd been there about a year, had mentioned the fact that he had had this journey from Syria to England. And it kind of gave him permission to tell his story, because suddenly the curriculum was just slightly, well, rather majorly, about him. Mm. And then, as I was talking, a Russian boy, we're back in a class, a Russian boy came and said, "Is it true that my country is bombing Syria?" And I said, "It is true, but then my country is also involved in bombing Syria too." So again, suddenly the curriculum opened out to two kids that had never mentioned where they came from, because the whole curriculum was narrowed down to a very Anglo-centric curriculum. Everything had been about English history, English geography, English interpretations of maths and science and so on. And suddenly in that session, the world opened out to include both their countries, and they found that they had a voice. And since then, I've been noticing that when we talk about where refugees come from, or some of the case study stories, kids who are somewhat marginalized, partly because of their ethnicity, but maybe because of other things, speak up. They feel that they're included. So the thing that I think mostly could change is for our curriculum to reflect the diversity of this country much more broadly. A curriculum which chooses examples and chooses scenarios and exercises and photographs and everything else that reflect this broad and very rich and creatively incredibly full of potential a population that we have here.
And that doesn't necessarily, though, have to mean a curriculum. You know, when you say curriculum, people are maybe interpret that as, well, we've got the curriculum that we've got. That doesn't mean it changes. It's how the school chooses to lead the curriculum.
You don't have to change anything of the curriculum itself. It's just the illustrations you use and the attitudes you take, that doesn't mean that we would change any of the targets, any of the stages that we do in terms of teaching each of the subjects. But the canvas that we paint that subject on can be much broader and use many more colours.
And finally, teachers are really busy people. We read and we hear about the stresses that teachers are under. And when you have a new child join your class, an English speaking child who brought up in England, you don't have all these socialisation issues to such an extent. It's hard enough. Yeah. Maybe teachers worry when they see or hear that there's going to be a new child in their class, but they don't speak English, and they've just made a very tricky transition or journey here. What would you say to reassure teachers that actually this is an opportunity and not something to worry about?
Well, it is a very real issue. And of course, the support that children in that position used to have was much greater. And so there are difficulties, and it does need more funding to support, to provide support for those. But on a human-to-human basis, just in terms of play, just in terms of art, in terms of sport, in terms of way-finding in geography, in terms of using photographs, there are so many things that do not require high levels of English to start the journey, to start that journey of communication. And the simple thing of smiling, of including, of choosing games where people have to cooperate, where young people have to cooperate and play together, all of those, you begin to see how rich the communication is between people on nonverbal levels. So not, for teachers not to worry too much about being verbal all the time, but having lots of nonverbal stuff, and noticing that in the playground, the kids very, very quickly learn informal English. and using that informal English as part of the lesson. The English that kids are learning in play is often very different from the rather more academic English, if you like, that they're learning in the classroom. So it's actually helping make that transition from what's been learned in a kind of relaxed and childlike and, you know, very easy way in play, and transitioning that into the classroom in ways. So those would be my sort of quick answers, but also to depend upon just the human element of making contact, human to human, in any way that we can.
So important. And we're coming to the end of our time, but one very, in a way, simple question, maybe not so simple, but what would you advise out of? So there is sometimes a lean to intervention. Let's get their English up to scratch. Let's take them out and do some English intervention, etc., and small group. Or versus the immersion idea, just let them get into the curriculum. They'll pick up the English, but it's important around the socialisation and being part of a community. Which one would you advise? Which way would you advise?
I think that the second integration one would be firmly the way I'd do it. But I know, as a teacher of long standing, that there is never a one size fits all for a whole. For a whole community, for a whole lot of children. Some children will need a little extra and separated help. But in my experience, the majority act like children everywhere in the world, that they play, that they learn, that they interact and communicate if the conditions in the classroom are such where that's easy, where there is group work, where there is there are opportunities for kind of playful attitudes, where there are opportunities outside the classroom. All of those things are places where those little bits of communication can happen, as it were, more naturally. So I would veer on that side, but I'm always reluctant to say do this, because I know that there are exceptions all the time, and that sometimes a child would prefer and learn better in a more formal and structured way.
Thank you, Jonathan, for your time today. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear your thoughts around refugee education, and I'm sure this will be so useful to many, many teachers who are working with these children and have the privilege of doing so. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine. Thanks a lot.